Welcome to XX Science. It's in your genes. Today is Friday, April 12th, 2013. I am Adrienne Rorick, chemistry editor. Today we have a slightly different setup of the podcast for you. Instead of two co-hosts, I have interviews with each of the XX Science editors with posts up in the earlier portion of this week. So let's get right into our week of posts. This week, we had six posts. The week started out on April 8th with health editor Tara Haley covering a new study from Australian researchers about penis size. Hello, Tara. Thank you for recording with me today.
Hi, Adrienne. How are you?
I'm doing good. I have to admit, your post had me kind of perhaps in a slightly different place all week. I have a drawing of a NMR tube cleaner on my chalkboard in my office, and every time I look at it, I kind of think it looks like a penis. And I have to say, I think we started out the week on XX Science with your post, "Does Penis Size Matter?" So tell me about this post, tell me about the study, and anything that might be of interest, which to me sounds like the whole thing.
Yeah, the story, obviously, it got a lot of press in many, many outlets. I think just because, I mean, it's a story about penis size. Of course, that's going to grab the headlines. And the study itself was not actually that remarkable. It was well done. It was well conducted. I think it's just what it was about. And I couldn't help but find it amusing that the four authors were four Australian men. So I'll just leave that to people to decide for themselves what that might mean. But basically, they were
I wondered if it wasn't the Southern Hemisphere, because your piece on farting a few weeks ago was from a couple Kiwis, right? Some New Zealanders?
That's true, yeah. Well, I've actually lived in Australia, and I will say that they have a pretty bawdy sense of humor, but that makes it a lot of fun, too.
Great.
So they basically wanted to know, men's pieces have always been right out there in center. Human men cannot retract their penises, so if they're walking around in the pre-clothing era, you can pretty much see what their goods are. Now, what that means is kind of what the study was looking at. What they did was they created a whole bunch of computerized figures, over 200 of them, that mixed up height, penis size, and shoulder to width size, which is like that V shape that men have that is thought to look more masculine if they have broader shoulders than they have hips. And they found that, yeah, penis size makes a slight difference, but not that much of a difference. And the way that they determined this was they had about 120-something women view 57 figures each and rate them in terms of sexual attractiveness. And then they determined what accounted for the differences based on the different traits that each of those figures had. So penis size was like 5.7%. It was a small amount. The shoulder to hip ratio accounted for 80% of the variation in the women's selections of sexual attractiveness. So really it was that masculine V shape that made the biggest difference. And then height and penis size were very, very close after that. They were like 6.5% and 5.5% each. So it was a pretty minor difference. So one thing that I thought was a limitation of the study, and I didn't address this completely in the post, is that you had predominantly white Australian women doing this. And I don't know that you can really completely remove the possible cultural bias that could exist there. You would have to conduct the study with women of many different cultures, many different times over, to really validate those results.
True.
One thing that's also interesting is that they did find differences in women's choices based on the women themselves, how the women looked. So slightly larger women tended to prefer slightly larger penises. Taller women preferred taller men, so right. Those two findings.
And we had a post on that just a few weeks ago, did we not?
Yes, we did. Yeah, yeah. The most important thing, I think, from this, the takeaway, is that penis size actually doesn't matter. Even though the finding was it matters a little bit, the size that they found, sort of the point past which it was diminishing returns, was 7.5 centimeters. Flaccid, which is pretty small. So no offense to anyone who's listening to this, but that's below average for most men based on population comparisons. And so if that's the point past which it doesn't really make that big of a difference, then the majority of men are doing okay. Not to mention the fact that there's the whole, you know, shower versus grower thing, and you don't know if what you see on the outside necessarily represents the full Monty when things are getting hot.
Yeah.
So I thought that the study was more a fun exercise. So basically, this was a pretty interesting study for Australian men wanted to find out whether penis size makes a difference. And while their methodology was pretty sound, there were major limitations built into the study. Basically, they wanted to know, did the fact that women could check men out, even from a distance in the days before clothing, did that make a difference in the development of men's penis sizes over an evolutionary time period? Was there a sexual selection going on when the women could pretty much see the men letting it all hang out in between hunting and gathering and all that other good stuff? The bottom line of the study, though, is, yeah, there's some evidence that penis size might matter a little bit, but really, in the big scheme of things, in the big scheme of things, it doesn't really matter that much. Between the fact that we have cultural biases that they couldn't control for, the fact that we can't take into account whether the men were quote-unquote showers or growers, not knowing if that's a myth or a reality, taking into account that the size at which there were diminishing returns was still below average for today's men, and just taking into account the fact that women would have had a chance to check out the guys when they were in their full glory, it's really tough to know whether this made a big difference. And then you throw in the fact that the majority of the difference was related to the men's physique overall, their V-shape masculine look. So even though the researchers concluded that penis size played a part, the part was such a minor part that I think it's pretty much negligible. Then you toss in the different phenotypes of the women involved and the fact that women are going to have their differences based on their physicalities and based on their own preferences. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that what really matters isn't the package the man brings, but the whole package the man brings. So I think that's going to make a bigger difference. And one other limitation that I didn't really discuss, but I think is something important to note, is they're also making the assumption that women are making a pretty important decision, a mate decision, based on a man's physicality.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to say that our ancient cave women were probably looking for other things besides a man's physique in choosing their mates. Did they want a mate who was more aggressive? Did they want a mate who had brought home more of the meat? The literal meat, not the little meat.
Yeah.
Did they want a man who showed leadership abilities? Did they want a man who simply set off little alarm bells and made them tingle? I think it's fair to say that intelligence and leadership skills and caring and all those other factors that we look at today probably made a difference back then as well. And I highly doubt that a little thing like a little member is going to make a huge influence on whether or not a woman chose to sleep with a man or not.
Thank you for joining me today, Tara. And a lot of people have appreciated your insight on the size of the penis.
No problem. Thank you. I certainly enjoy any opportunity to investigate things about the male penis.
On Tuesday and Thursday, we had a couple posts about women scientists. On April 9th, physics editor Matthew Francis explained the science of Yvonne Brill. And my own post went up on April 11th about the seven women in the 1966 edition of The Modern Men of Science. Matthew and I were able to have a brief discussion about these two posts. Welcome, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining me today. So I wanted to talk about our posts where you discussed Yvonne Brill and the satellite revolution she made possible.
Yes, well, this is one of those stories that started off with a negative. Sometimes you have to learn that somebody died before you realize how important they were, and Yvonne Brill is certainly one of those. The first I had ever even heard of her was when the New York Times ran an obituary where they decided that the most important thing to talk about was her beef stroganoff recipe, which evidently was really good. Emily Willingham wrote about that for XX, about why that was a bad idea. But as I read more about her, I realized you know, this is one of the unsung heroes of spaceflight in the United States and by extension in the world, because she figured out a way to satellites in what's called a geostationary orbit, where it stays over the same spot on Earth all the time.
That's
what makes communication satellites work. You have to be able to keep a satellite in a position where you know exactly where it is at all times. And so she figured out how to create a rocket thruster system that would make that possible. An adapted version of her system was used on the space shuttle, and then a number of other things have used it as well. So basically we owe a lot to this invention and by extension to Yvonne Brill. And so it's really funny that, put it one way, we don't often know who are the engineers. We talk about the spacecraft, we talk about the astronauts, but we don't always talk about the engineers that make things possible. So that's one strike against her. And the second strike is, it seems like whenever we write about women in science, we have to talk about their families first, or, you know, we have to emphasize that their career didn't prevent them from having a quote-unquote normal life. And
right. Or it's just conveniently not mentioned if what they did was dedicate their life to their career, right?
Exactly. But I deliberately did not write an obituary, actually. I wrote about her science. We all use communication satellites. Well, okay. Those of us in the first world with advanced technology use communication satellites every day. We don't even notice it.
Right. Well, and all world governments use those.
Right.
And therefore the people of the world who have governments in existence are also affected by those satellites. Decisions
exactly.
are made based on the information coming through those satellites.
Exactly. It's hard to miss how important, I mean, you have to try to miss how important this was, her contribution was. You know, I am no rocket scientist. I'm the first to admit that. That's not my area at all. I have to learn quite a bit about rocket science to write this story. I'm a physicist, but, you know, I can appreciate engineering. I can appreciate how hard this is and how also, frankly, under-acknowledged how creative a field engineering is. You have a problem in front of you, and you have to solve it in a creative way that's going to work, and it's going to work every time you do it, because you cannot fly up into orbit to fix things when they go wrong. The satellite has to be able to either fix itself or has to be able to deorbit in a way that's not going to kill people.
Right. Yeah. That's fascinating. I really enjoyed this piece. It was very interesting to learn about this rocket science. And I, of course, heard all about the commotion over the obituary for Yvonne Brill, especially since one of the satires and of the New York Times obituary and why that wasn't a very well-done piece appeared on XX Science. But I also wasn't aware of what she had done, right? And so really, your piece made me go, oh, wow, that was where I really realized exactly what you did, because that is a problem I have thought about, where you need the energy to break the atmosphere and end up in space, and that energy required is directly related to your weight, and so you need to add
right.
fuel. And so it's really a circular problem, and she's the one who figured out how to fix that problem, and that's just amazing, because I have asked that question in the past, how is that? And, you know, most people don't know, but.
Well, I admit I hadn't thought about it as much as, you know, I might have. I've actually thought more about, you know, probes going to other planets than I thought about satellites orbiting around Earth. If you had pressed me, I could have told you that you need to put energy into the satellite just to keep it up.
Yeah.
Against the drag, and also, you know, if the orbit isn't exactly perfect, then you need to make corrections every now and then. I would have been able to tell you that, but, you know, it's not something you think about very often, but obviously somebody does have to think about it.
This sort of controversy that the death of Yvonne Brill stirred up is somewhat represented by women throughout the history of science, right? We've had women have been in science since one of the first scientists I ever highlighted in our Notable Women of Science was Miriam the Alchemist, who lived in the first or second century of the Common Era. And there's enough references about her that she was a real person. And we've highlighted nearly 75 women, and I have hundreds more. I have a huge list, so I plan to do a lot more writing. But one book I checked out was this Modern Men of Science, because I'd heard there were women in there. And I found 7 women. I went through all 400-some. And many of these women are overlooked. Of these 7 women, I had already highlighted 2 of them. Dorothy Crowfoot Hodgkin appeared in Crystallographers, and Maria Geppert Mayer was highlighted in one of our historical physicist posts. But the other women, Catherine Esau, Dame Honor Bridget Fell, Dame Kathleen Lonsdale, Lisa Meitner, and Mildred Trotter hadn't appeared yet, and they were noteworthy enough to, in 1966, appear in this, but they're often overlooked to history, too. Some of these women, other people might know. Lisa Meitner herself is particularly of note because she's a great story of, well, a great story of a woman who was overlooked, right?
Thankfully, I think the physics community has done a little bit of a better job in giving her her due. But at the time, when she was alive, she was not nearly as honored as she should have been. And for those who don't know who she was one of a small group of physicists who figured out how to achieve nuclear fission. So when you think about a nuclear reactor, that's taking an atomic nucleus and inducing it to split into smaller nuclei. And she was one of the ones who figured out how to do that. So basically, all nuclear power comes from that kind of work. That was challenging work, and she did a lot of this work in Nazi-dominated Europe in the years preceding World War II. She was protected from being fired from her university position by her Austrian citizenship. Of course, the Nazis were not that fond of women in positions of authority either, so she had several strikes against her. And frankly, it needs to be said too that the Nobel Prize Committee of that era was both down on women and anti-Semitic.
Okay.
Einstein is a case where there was naked anti-Semitism that delayed his Nobel Prize. They actually refused to give a prize 1 year because they knew that it would have to be given to Einstein by rights because of all of his achievements. And so they refused to give a prize that year and then gave it to him next year. And then they retroactively called it the prize from the year before. Well, I think there was probably some of that going on with Meitner as well. As a Jewish woman, obviously Marie Curie won 2 Nobel Prizes, so it wasn't that all women were excluded from prizes, but there's no reason Meitner should have been overlooked.
No,
in fact,
much of her work was very similar to Curie's, especially in how groundbreaking it was and whatnot. And they were in related fields, essentially.
She was actually in as important a position academically. She was the first woman to be a full professor at her university. So it wasn't like she was working in obscurity by any means. And of course, if you know nuclear physics, you know you can't do that without funding. You can't do it without a good facility. She was obviously very successful in real world terms. We have to acknowledge that the Nobel Prize is given by human beings, and sometimes those human beings have prejudices, and sometimes those prejudices are ugly.
Yeah, the person she worked with, Otto Hahn, received that 1945 Nobel Prize for essentially her work. And it took until 1966 for the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission's Fermi Award to be awarded to Lisa Meitner. And that was supposed to be sort of the next best thing. It was the only way to make up her lack of a Nobel Prize, I suppose.
I suppose, yeah.
That's sort of the prize they've acknowledged.
We can look at Lisa Meitner's life and work and say she did more with all of the disadvantages of being a Jewish woman working in Nazi-dominated Europe and still do more than I've ever been able to do in my career. I mean, come on, she kicks my butt all over the place. So what can I say?
Yeah, me too.
You know. She doesn't have to win a Nobel Prize for us to acknowledge that she was awesome.
Yes. Well, it's been great talking to you, Matthew, about all these wonderful women of science, both on this, the Women in Modern Men of Science, and Yvonne Brill and her satellite revolution that she made possible.
Thank you.
Last week, biology editor Jeannie Garbarino and I discussed our science interest origins and how we stayed in science. Our science
education editor Chris Gunter wrote a post on stereotype threat about women staying in science, and she begins with a question about, obviously, people are interested in science, and if you're female, getting that interest is not necessarily the question, but how do you stay in science? And so today I have Chris with me. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Adrian.
And we can talk about this post a little bit. So, Chris, can you summarize your post just briefly for those who haven't had a chance to read it yet?
Yeah, sure. I had written a column in March for the journal Genome Biology where I talked about this concept of stereotype threat, and I wasn't really sure how much people knew about it, but then I was sitting having my morning coffee and Sheryl Sandberg was being interviewed on Morning Edition on NPR about her book Lean In that's just come out. Okay. And one of the things she said was she started talking about stereotype threat, and I thought, oh, perhaps I should write something else about this. So the concept is that whenever a group is told in advance or learns a stereotype that it's not supposed to be good at something, that when you later ask that group to do something, they perform worse at it than if you had never told them that, or if they had never been exposed to that stereotype. If you have a group of students who are of different ethnic origins and you tell the whole class that one ethnic group is worse at some test and then they take the test, that ethnic group on average does worse than if you never said anything. So the same thing often applies to women. That's what Sheryl Sandberg was saying, is what she said, what's holding women back in computer science is the exact same thing that's holding back in women back in leadership. It's something social scientists call stereotype threat. She said, you know, again, stereotype, we believe girls aren't good at math, and that self-perpetuates. Right. And that's what I learned about when I was writing this column, and I thought, honestly, really, aren't we kind of beyond that? I mean, double X science, doesn't everyone know that by now, right? That women and girls can be just as good. But then what sparked me to write this post are a couple of things that happened in the last few weeks, the biggest one being Elise Andrew and her Facebook page, I Effing Love Science, which has 4.3 million plus followers. And I somehow picked up that it was a woman, and so it wasn't a surprise to me when she opened a Twitter account a few weeks ago and put her picture on there, and it was a woman. And yet there was this furor on the web about, can you believe that's a woman? And people come out and said, oh, you're so hot, and all these kind of stereotypical
things. Right, all the normal stereotypes and sexism that comes out that we're told doesn't exist.
And then yet there it was, right? Yes. And so I added that in there. And then there was another post by a friend of Double X Science, Matt Schiffman, who's in North Carolina, and he has a blog on science communication, which you should really check out if you never have. And he covered a paper that came out, and that paper, you'll have to read my post, is really complicated. But the gist of it was summarized in their concluding sentence, which was, the overall conclusion is that male scholars will have a much smoother ride, especially if they work on male-type topics. Which is frustrating for all of us to hear. So at the end of the post, I gave a couple of examples of things that you can do if you're trying to get your girls interested in STEM, if you're trying to be a woman and role model, that women can be in STEM. And so there's some ideas on there.
Great. Now, I was actually just listening to a podcast by Get It Done Guy about, he talks about management and stuff and business and whatnot. But, you know, I thought it kind of applied because he talked about the Rosenthal effect, which is basically how your beliefs shape those around you. And he gave the example that I actually always give, and that is that what teachers believe about their students ends up coming true regardless of what any predetermined actual testing of those students' abilities is. And it wasn't that they were explicit that girls can't do math. It was that they held this cultural bias that girls can't do math, and they were somehow expressing it unintentionally. And so that is part of, I think, this whole thing of how women don't stay in STEM, right? And last week on the podcast, Jeannie Garbarino and I discussed in the intro how we got interested in science and our origin stories, but we also continued with how we stayed in science, and a lot of it has to do with a supportive network. I had supportive parents, both had really supportive teachers, that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think it's not just the teachers. It is, and I'm sure we have talked about this many times on Double X Science, it's the media as well. Just they're constantly bombarded with stereotypes in the media about girls not being able to do STEM and that kind of thing. It's just floating out there, which is just really unfortunate. And I did mention that in the post that there was a report from the Girl Scouts of America. And if you're interested in this topic, I encourage you to read that as well, that came out last year. And they say at most 36% of girls indicated that they had done any after school or summer programs that related related to STEM. And those are great opportunities to get girls interested in STEM, to have them see that women can do these things, which, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, do math and do physical chemistry, which, eek, but yeah. I'm a biologist. That's hard for me. So, but I think that's great. I mean, that's the important point, is that the girls see that women can do it, that the stereotype is not true.
Right. And help break down that stereotype and show. And you're right. And I think it is a very big whole blow up about Lisa Andrew, where she had started this website at 4.3 million followers, but her gender was not explicit there. And then she comes out and has a picture of her as a presenting woman. She doesn't, and all of a sudden everything blows up because a large number of people didn't realize that a woman could love science and run such a great website. And in whatever way, then they show it in, you know, also in an inappropriate way. So that's just the culture and the stereotype.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just a stereotype.
Well, and that was her comment that I put in the post. She said that a lot of the commenters actually said they were very surprised. They had the same bias within themselves. They were saying, I didn't realize I had this, but I obviously do. I never thought I was sexist. I never dreamed I had this bias, but it was there. Right? So that's, again, an example of how it's just floating around in the culture.
Right.
And why we need double X science.
Exactly. So, yeah, and this even reminds me of the fur over the video that was produced in the UK to try to get girls interested in STEM, but all they did was reinforce quite a few stereotypes.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Yeah, so this is a great article. It's got a lot of information, a lot of summary, and I encourage everyone to go over and read that at Double X Science. It's called Stereotype Threat by Chris Gunter. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
On Friday, April 12th, we had two posts up about mental illness. The first post was a post by Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham called McConnell and Mental Illness. And it was a post about this leak of tapes where U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell were discussing ways to use Ashley Judd's history of depression against her in a political office race. The post goes into the perception of mental illness and how mental illness is still different, is still considered different in the culture than any other physical illness, despite the fact that mental illness is a physical illness. We also had our regular I Am Mental Illness series post, which we've talked about extensively on this podcast about the series, and this post was called Knowing When You Need a Therapist by an anonymous contributor. We accept contributions from people using initials, pseudonyms, real names, and even can post under anonymous contributor, although you must be using your full real name, to our editor-in-chief, Emily Willingham. This post isn't discussing when you should see a therapist. It's a personal post written about somebody feeling that they do not need to see a therapist, even though they know they actually should go see a therapist about their suicidal ideation. You can find all these posts at our website, doublexscience.org, by clicking on the links to the posts on the main page. Double X Science's sister site, Double X Science Jr., had two posts this week. Tuesday was about procrastination, and it was an infographic. This post was a very popular post, and it's a fun little infographic to go take a look at. It's mostly about procrastinating your work using social media. Thursday, we had a nice short little post about the Lazarus sign, so please go check those out at doublexsciencejr.blogspot.com, or you can follow the link to Double X Science Jr. from the doublexscience.org main page.